We're talking about the criminal work. I think we can start with the story about what we just left off on. The man who killed the boy.
Oh, yes. One of my appointments was to defend a handsome, personable young construction worker who had been working on a construction site out at ADAC, and he had beaten up on the camp bully. The camp bully had a reputation and a practice of picking on smaller, older fellas when they were drunk and beating them up. And so on one occasion, my young client just decided he'd seen too much of that, and he went out and beat the camp bully senseless and then kicked him a whale of a kick with his big construction boot. He was charged with murder as a result of the death of the camp bully. But from a combination of facts, we were able to show that the unconscious victim had been hauled in a Jeep over a very rough road for a number of miles to get him either to a medical facility or to a plane to transport him to a medical facility. But at any rate, he did die. And my client chose to stand trial rather than enter any kind of a plea. And the jury apparently liked my client as I did. I rather admired what he had been prompted to do, although I didn't admire the extra kick he gave when it was all over. But the jury, I'm sure, were both maybe liked both him and me. And at any rate, they found him not guilty of murder or manslaughter, but of a much lesser includable offense of something in the nature of a justified assault. And he was sentenced to 6 months, which he served. And shortly after he got back into town, and before I'd seen him again, he was killed in a street fight. So that, along with the fact that other people I had defended very soon repeated or did something similar or worse, led me to the conclusion that I didn't want to continue really putting some of the best days of my life, days and nights, working and thinking and trying for these people, and all to no avail. So as a result, I came to a conclusion I didn't want to continue to try criminal cases.
Backtracking just a little bit, did you ever rib in the courtroom when Cy Helenthal was judged?
Yes, yes. I got a little acquainted with him. He was a fine gentleman, too. He came up from his court seat in Juneau on occasion to fill in up here. And I particularly remember one occasion I was in with Bill on some matter. Bill made a motion or an objection or argued a motion, and Cy ruled against him, and Bill's form of objection was not, "Your Honor, I wish the record to note." Bill simply said, "God damn it, Cy, you can't do that." That's my the one recollection that comes quickly to me. I don't have any other particular events that would be of interest.
What did Cy Helenthal do when he went through?
I don't know whether he showed, I don't remember whether he showed color in his face or not, but his manner and voice remained calm, and he said, "Counsel, I think we should go into chambers."
Did Renfrew ever do anything like that with Judge Diamond?
Not as outlandish as that. He would grumble and moan and show his displeasure, and no cursing or personal assault, verbal assault on him. Yes. Everybody's had some cases with Grigsby. He was a really an interesting man to watch and be around. He was an excellent criminal defense attorney, as well as handled some good civil cases. He was in court pretty regularly, even though he got well up in the years. He tried cases on a regular schedule, and when he wasn't trying them, he was working in the library. George had not gone to law school and had never had a course in legal bib or legal research, but he'd get back in those old decennial digests and plow through them and find a case in point in every case I knew of him to try. He had one good case in point, and he never came in with a bunch of cases or didn't confuse the court with cases that were similar or comparable. He found his one case and stood on it. I had a trial against him. Grigsby won more of his cases than he lost, and I really thought I had him in the famous case of Bell versus Jones. There were two homesteaders down the Seward Highway, just a little bit north of O'Malley Road. William Jones was Grigsby's client, and Bell was my client. They were homesteading across the road from each other. Jones still lives down on part of his homestead. And I represented Bell, the plaintiff, suing Jones for negligently burning down my client's home on the homestead. And the facts were that Jones had been clearing land and was burning the berm, or the logs and timber that he knocked down, and both of them worked on the base at various civilian jobs. And on the morning of the mishap, Jones had gone off to work, leaving the fire burning in his berm. And it was gusty, and the flames got across the road and burned down my client's home. And we tried the case for 4 or 5 days before a jury, and I was winning every day and every hour of the day until the last few minutes of the trial, and I had rested our case, and Grigsby recalled my client and put him on the stand and re-examined him about the morning that of the day this happened. And Grigsby asked him, now, you saw Mr. Jones leave for work? Yes. You saw the fire burning in the logs? Yes. Were there really flames, or was there just smoke? Oh, there were flames. Well, how high were the flames? this high, and he held his hand up above his head. And Grigsby asked him, and what did you do? He said, I went to work. And then just those three or four questions at the end, my case was blown because he was so negligent himself in going off and not doing a thing to protect his property from the gusts of those flames. And the jury wasn't out very long. Oh, one of Renfrew's cases.
Is that one of Renfrew's
cases? Yes. I've forgotten the name of the merchant who was his defendant. It's a familiar family name down there, and his boys are still there. But at that time, the Army didn't have cold storage facilities, and so they were storing their cases of fresh eggs in the cool room under this merchant's store. But the Army apparently found that frequently when they went into inventory their cases of fresh eggs, they were a few cases short. So they started keeping observers on it. And one night the observers found the merchant taking cases of eggs out through a window at the back of the cold storage room under the store. They reported him, and he was arrested. Renfrew defended. And I couldn't imagine how he was going to have any possible defense. But he defended successfully by getting a veterinarian in to testify, and it is true, I learned then and later, that if cases of eggs aren't turned over occasionally, the yolk sinks to the bottom and the egg spoils more quickly. And so the good old merchant, for no pay or compensation, was working nights, taking those eggs out the back window, turning the cases over. And his defense was successful.
Wait, the jury believed
the that? Jury acquitted.
Did the jury want to acquit, and they just wanted something to acquit with? Or?
I can't tell you whether it was just a case of an Alaskan jury thinking the big old Army had plenty of eggs anyway, or whether it was just a case of reasonable doubt.
That the jury was an Alaskan jury and they were just going to go a certain way because they were.
I think, yes, in those days that you took more chances in going to trial because of the Alaska atmosphere.
Who were they for? What were their biases?
Excuse me. I think there was an Alaskan atmosphere that a number of people who had come up here for various reasons didn't favor law and regulation and law enforcement on their over their personal lives. I think everybody recognized that some police protection was necessary and that murder and robbery were wrong, but many people wanted a free lifestyle, and I think probably defense attorneys were willing to try cases that maybe they today would not try on the hopes that that free spirit of Alaska would pervade the jury and they would not be sympathetic to the prosecution.
You had a case before Judge Fulton.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about Judge Fulton.
Well, Judge Fulton was a very stern judge. He had been a prosecutor all of his career, I think, before he became judge, and he was prosecution-minded, and he kept the defense reined in very tightly. I think he firmly believed that almost everyone who was arrested and brought before him was guilty, and I think he showed the jury that he expected them to convict. In those days, capital punishment was available in Alaska, and Judge Folta used it. He had a reputation of using it. He was sometimes referred to as the hanging judge, and I was appointed on a case where a man was charged with shooting a native woman in a cabin up in the valley, and he insisted he didn't do it. He insisted to me that he didn't do it, that the woman was his friend or had become his friend during the weekend, that they had partied together, that they were staying together that night, and that they drank a lot, that he didn't remember everything, but he remembered getting up and leaving. But the evidence looked pretty bad against him. I think I persuaded Judge Folta to allow me expenses for an investigator for 2 days investigating work, and the investigator couldn't find anything that might point at another suspect, at any rate, the culmination was that I felt in trying the prospect of trying that case before Judge Folta, I didn't have any chance of gaining an acquittal, and that probably the client would end up hanging. And I explained it to him over and over, and in the last hour before the trial commenced, he authorized me to see what I could do in negotiating a plea. And so when court opened, I asked for additional time to consult with the prosecution, and in the afternoon I went in and pled him to second degree, I believe, and he was sentenced to 20 years. And sometime when he, after he'd served maybe 15 years, he filed a motion for review, for dismissal of the charges on the grounds that he had incompetent counsel. And the case was referred up here, and the whoever then was district attorney contacted me, and I gave an affidavit confirming the fact that I felt he had incompetent counsel. And I don't know what the outcome was after that. Yeah. But, no, that one, under the circumstances, I was afraid to try it because I thought the results would be the worst possible.
Was there any way that you could ask for a different judge? You could ask for Judge Diamond in the case?
I didn't do it. And I don't think if I'd filed such a motion before Judge Folta, he would have granted it. No. And we didn't have a panel of judges. There was just one in each division of Alaska.
Yeah. Was Folta the only one who used capital punishment?
He's the only one that I recall having done it. There may have many years earlier been other judges and other cases where capital punishment was employed, but I don't know of them.
But not in the time that you were practicing?
No.
When you were when you were done working for Davis and Renfrew, you said you spent about a year and a half working
there? I think so. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's about 1948, 1949?
A couple years. It was a little over 2 years. I remember, too, we had 2 year-end settlements with bonuses. Mm-hmm. And so sometime into the third year, Wendell and I formed a partnership.
Why did you form a partnership with Wendell Penn?
Wendell had not been in private practice too long, maybe just about those 2 years, but he was trying quite a few cases. He had been counsel to the, I think, the Alaska Housing Authority before he came into private practice. And I think we had a case or two together. And Wendell was sort of a spokesman and cheerleader for the Democratic Party, and he would serve as master of ceremonies at their Jefferson Jackson Day dinners, and sometimes I served as master of ceremonies for the Republican Lincoln Day dinners, and we rivaled in those activities. And at some point, after we had opposed each other in a fairly substantial case, Wendell came to me and he said, I rode out in the car with Judge Diamond to the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner today, and he said, you had just finished a jury trial that week, and Judge Diamond said to me something to the effect that Paul Robeson can convince a jury of anything. Well, after that bit of flattery, Wendell remarked that he was wanting to open an office on his own. I think he'd been working with Warren Cuddy, and Warren Cuddy's office space was available, and Wendell suggested that he thought we might make a good partnership and that we would enjoy practicing together, and I agreed with him, and so we became partners.
I'm going to backtrack a little again. When did you first become involved in politics in Alaska?
In late summer of 48, I read that there was going to be a Republican Club meeting, and I had been active in Republican politics, young Republican politics in Kansas. So I went to that meeting, and they were within a short time of the fall election for the legislature. They had just a few candidates, not enough to contest every seat, no platform, no campaign manager, no party organization, no Republican Club. And several people from National Bank of Alaska were there. They seemed to be the core of the active participants. There were at least three or four. I remember George Mumford and Rod Johnston, and I don't remember whether Elmer was there or not, probably not. And anyway, I heard the discussion and asked some questions and volunteered to help them write a platform. And so I wrote a 10-plank platform for them and went out and tried to raise a few dollars, and campaigns were not expensive in those days. And we may have raised $500 or some magnificent sum like that, and published their platforms, and I think they gave a few little 5-minute radio talks, and maybe I gave a talk for them. I can remember young man named Wally Hickel was there also. And I think that was his first political meeting in Alaska. Uh-huh. And he was a very well-built, tanned young man in a white T-shirt. I think maybe he had started building houses. But anyway, he wanted to say something, and he got up and started talking, and Rod Johnston was presiding at the meeting. And Rod said, young man, you don't have the floor. And Wally said, God damn it, I'm standing on it. And he made his point, and he, from that point on, was active in Republican politics also. Mm-hmm. Later, I managed the next Republican campaign, and we got several more into the legislature. And I ran in 52 for a 2-year term in the territorial Senate, and as a result of all the good speeches I wrote and having Ike on the ticket as a candidate for president, we ended up on the right side that time and had a pretty near complete sweep. Poor Wendell was one of a 5-man minority in the House of Representatives that year, as I recall. He had a few good ideas which we adopted and passed into law, but he had some he hadn't been able to get in while he was in the majority. Yes, I believe we were. That was, I think we formed our partnership in 51. He may correct me on that, but I believe we formed it in 51, and that as a result of the 52 election, we were serving in the 53 session.
Practicing
together while you were both in the legislature. I don't mean
political problems. Well, you can start with political problems.
I don't remember any items that became problems that our clients, some may not have been aware that we were actively contesting against each other in our political parties. Some, of course, were aware and laughed about it. Some thought we were getting a corner on politics. Some probably questioned our ethics, but I don't remember anybody accusing me of being a bad person because I associated with that horrible Democrat.
What about holding your practice together when you both had political involvement in the legislature and meetings and everything else?
It's my experience your practice suffers. There are some benefits. I'm sure that if you're prominent in the legislature, that you pick up some clients who think you'll be favorable to their interests or can be influential on behalf of their interests. But my experience and observation generally is that when an attorney is out of town for 2 months or more at a time, your clients are apt to go to someone else. They want to have an attorney who's there when they need him. And so I think that shows up by the fact that there are hardly any attorneys in the Alaska legislature at the present time. I think maybe there's only one in the House and one in the Senate. sessions were only 60 days long in those days, and only every other year. They didn't meet annually. So it, the damage to the practice was not as serious as it would be now when the sessions maybe run 4 months or more, and every year, mm-hmm. and more committee work and hearings in the off legislative season.
There were quite a few lawyers in the legislature when you were there.
Yes. Nothing like a majority, but a good representation. I think we need more. I think there should be a number of lawyers in both houses.
Were you in the 55 legislature?
53.
In the 55, it was over half attorneys.
Was it? I didn't realize. Yeah. I didn't realize. I was down there. I was serving as executive or administrative assistant to Governor Heintzelman. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that lawyers predominated. I'm surprised. I'd forgotten that.
Were you there when they had the Integrated Bar Act, when that was formed? Do you know any of the politics behind that?
I think I remember that Pete Calamarides was one of the active sponsors of it, and I don't remember who else was. I remember that part of the rationale was that if we didn't form one, somebody else would form one we wouldn't like as much.
Who else would form one?
I don't know whether the thought was that the court was going to prescribe a set of functional rules where we would be in effect part of the court system, or I don't remember what the alternatives were. I was not active in helping set it up. I don't remember now. I don't remember now. I'm sure Wendell would have a good recollection on that.
When you were administrative assistant to Governor Heintzelman, mm-hmm. were you still practicing, or had you taken off? Or?
I just took off for that period of time. Read the bills and advised the governor on what their effect would be, and was somewhat his liaison to the legislature.
Were you his legal counsel?
In effect, yes. Uh-huh. There was an attorney general, a territorial attorney general, but not very much. He was of a different party. In fact, it was Jerry Williams, as I recall. And Governor Heintzelman was not a politician. Jerry Williams knew his way around politics very well. And I think Governor Heintzelman was a little timid or reluctant in relying on Jerry if there was any political consequence involved in the litigation, in the legislation. One example that the idea of a territorial governor was becoming less popular in Alaska at that time, and the statehood movement was gaining considerable momentum, and some of the bright Democrat lawyers conceived the idea of passing a law providing for an elective territorial governor, which they did pass, and it came upstairs, and Governor Heintzelman asked me to check out the legality and see whether he had to sign it or let it become law or what he should do about it. So I did my best, perhaps only good piece of legal writing when I wrote his veto message. I'd like to read it again sometime. It was good.
I'd love to see that. So did you have any ties with Jerry Williams at the time?
We were friends, acquaintances, not close. He lived in Juneau fairly full-time in connection with his job, although his job took him out of state on travel a good proportion of the time. Mm-hmm. But as he says, he always got back in time to collect his paycheck.
So he was out of state a lot?
Yes.
What was the job of the Attorney General then? We're getting a little off track.
Well, it's comparable to what the Attorney General's role is now. Mm-hmm. Much smaller scope, but the same set of duties to... it was the state's law office for... both prosecution and for civil cases in which the state was involved, and to advise the governor and the executive department of the state, the boards and commissions.
But you did most of the advising?
To the governor, yeah, during that period, yeah.
What about the partitioning? Somebody mentioned that you advised the governor against some sort of partitioning plan that was being proposed?
Yes, various proposals that during that period of years had been put forth. The Secretary of Interior was the strong position as far as Alaska was concerned, that except for military matters, defense matters, almost everything came under the purview or the control of the Secretary of Interior. And historically, all the Secretaries of Interior were extremely unpopular in Alaska. That was one thing you could get a consensus on here. And at one time, a proposal to create a Commonwealth of Alaska, such as I think Puerto Rico was then, and it had some popularity, a minority popularity up here. It would have given us more freedom and more control and no taxation. But the majority of Alaskans didn't opt for that. And finally, early in the Eisenhower presidency, a proposal came out to partition Alaska to permit statehood. Do you want to shut that off? Yes, and in the early Eisenhower presidency, a proposal was made through the Secretary of Interior as the president's idea that Alaska be partitioned and that the major areas would be permitted to become a state, but that the northern and western tier would be excluded for military purposes as a military zone. And that trial balloon was floated up here and had considerable reaction. I think at first Governor Heintzelman perhaps was favorable to it, thinking it was a real good first step achievement on the road to full statehood. And the public had mixed reaction to it. The most of the press was opposed to it, and I think most of the leadership of the statehood organization was opposed to it. And I guess as a result of the general Alaskan reaction in our conversations. Governor Heintzelman, if he seemed to favor it at first, in the long run didn't favor it.
Did you have a hand in making this favorite?
I suppose I did. I can't really claim any credit for it. There, he was hearing from a lot of people on it.
Did you write any bills, or did you help?
The session I was in the legislature, I wrote a lot of bills. As I recall, I wrote 37 bills that were enacted. I had other people introduce some of them. There's a limit to how much you can put your own
signature
on. But we got a lot of good bills through. We didn't have the Legislative Council then, and one of the bills that I am pleased to have written was the one that created the Alaska Legislative Council. And
when did that go into effect?
In late 53. I was honored to be the first chairman of the Legislative Council, and it became the bill drafting arm of the legislature. Prior to that, legislators would draft their own, or maybe have a hometown attorney help them draft, or they would have the attorney general draft for them.
Who made up the legislative council when you were the head of it?
I believe Dick Gruel, from a legislator from Fairbanks. Fred Eastaw, I believe. I think there was one from Nome.
An attorney?
No, I believe he was a native, a good legislator. I don't remember his name at the moment. There were, I think, five members. And they really served as a bipartisan council. I was very, very proud of them. We considered our projects. We hired a capable executive. Grace Berg Scheibel was one of our first key staff on that legislative council. She did most of our writing. I don't remember now who the other two members were.
Is there any other legislation that you're especially proud of?
Well, we created the Alaska Highway Patrol, which is now the state, Alaska State Police.
How about the university?
Oh, yeah, the community college. We created the community colleges, authorized the creation of them and funded it. Agricultural Loan, Revolving Loan Act. I hadn't thought about that before our interview. I didn't know we'd be getting into legislation.
Were there any things that that you saw in your practice that you went to the legislature and knew you'd try to change? I realize we are off some of the things that I discussed before.
Yes. One, I don't know how proud I am today, but I was proud at the time. We abolished two or three boards or commissions that were dominated by Democrats, as would be expected after many years of Democratic control. One was the Employment Security Commission. We felt that they were too loose in their control of the funds, and that they were qualifying people who earned big money and shouldn't be qualified. We had we put in the concept of seasonality, which I think has since been discarded, but that in effect a person would have to work in more than one quarter of the year to be entitled to full unemployment benefits. In those days, more than now, we really had seasonality of employment up here, and people would come up and make good money in construction and fishing in one season, but then be able to draw full benefits, the same as if a full-time resident who tried to work all year became unemployed. So we reversed that for a few years.
Were there other things that you've seen in your practice, laws that you thought should be changed?
I'm sure there were, but I would have to review now to see what we worked on.
moving a little bit away from the political.
Okay.
In 1952, Eisenhower appointed new judges. Did you have a hand in the Republican appointment?
Yes, I did. I was active in party work here, and as was Harold Stringer, as a member of the bar, and we were contacted and asked to make suggestions of attorneys to be considered for that appointment, which we did. There were very few Republican attorneys practicing in this division at that time.
Did you go to Judge Diamond first?
Yes, I did. We talked it over, Harold and I did, and with other people who had been active in the party here, and we all decided that